Welcome to The Parent Equation with me, Aisha Murray, the podcast series where working parents share their unique stories of raising a family alongside their careers. The conversations I'm privileged to have are inspiring, uplifting, emotive, and most of all, honest. So I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoy recording them. So today I am joined by Dr. Chelsea. Chelsea is the owner of Positive Parenthood, which we will get into in a bit more detail. So welcome, Chelsea. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited for this conversation.
And I should probably mention that Chelsea joins us from the States. So you can tell us where you're dialing in from today.
Yeah, I'm coming from Santa Cruz, California. So just a couple minutes away from the beach, but up in the mountains. And it's good to connect with people who are from all over the place.
Nice. I imagine your weather is a damn sight better than ours. But we won't go down that because I'll feel very jealous and very envious. So we won't cover that topic today. So the first thing I think, and it's obviously the most obvious question to start with, what is positive parenthood and how did you start in this kind of arena?
Yeah, Positive Parenthood is an organization that supports parents and also teachers, right? I do some teacher coaching as well. And I used to be a professor of education. And so when I had my three kids, right, they're all very close in age. I have a set of twins and then one who's a year and a half younger. It just was too much. Mm-hmm. And so I left that job and I took my research out of educational neuroscience, social emotional learning, and I transformed it for parents, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just been amazing because previously, you know, I was having some impact. I was writing articles, I was doing research, and I was in a conversation with other academics. But I love being in a conversation with the people who are actually with kids all the time, right? Which is parents and teachers. So it's been really lovely. And I'll just say that the other thing about that is that I'm doing it with my mom, which is a thing that I never would have expected, right? But my mom is also a PhD in the field, and she actually has had this course for several years, and she and I came together, actually took it because I was struggling so much. And after I took it from her, I was like, oh my gosh, we have to work together, right? We have to do this. And so we revamped it and we teach it together now.
So do you think then going from being an academic in the field to, as you say, putting it into practice with parents and with teachers, how has that changed your perception of raising your own kids?
So much. So when, you know, full disclosure, when we started, I started doing this because I had the idea that I was going to be able to like easy breezy parenting, because of my research, mm-hmm. right? And because I had worked with so many children and families, I thought this will be fine when I'm a parent. And it's just like famous last words, right? I really struggled. Most of the time it was like all of us, all four of us crying all at the same time, me included. And I also started parenting a teenage niece at that time. Mm-hmm. So I was like three babies under two and a teenager. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard. It was really, really challenging. And I just was at a loss, you know, it's like, I knew all of the theory, but I was unable to like resolve my twins fighting over the only purple spoon, right? No other color would do. Right. And so working with my mom and translating all of that theory into practical tools really transformed just the culture of our family, right? Like how we were being together. So that's been really important. And I will say, you know, of course we all still have hard times and it goes in and out. Right? But having the tools, like having positive relationship-based tools that work for my kids and that work for me, it really transforms things, right? It's like, oh, I know I have some options for what to do when my child is having a meltdown. And I have some options for like how to be when they're not having a meltdown so that the meltdowns are much fewer.
Mm. And I think so full disclosure. So, and thank you for that. It's so important because we all, I think when we go into parenthood, imagine, not well, rose-tinted perhaps. We read all the books, we read all the textbooks, we get all the advice from friends and family, too much of that, I imagine. And then when it actually happens, it is really nothing, obviously, like we were expecting it to be. And usually thrown completely off guard. So your, I suppose, your mission to put this theory into practice for people is so important. Otherwise, we are just stuck with this theoretical view of what being a parent is.
Yeah, theoretical view. And I also think, you know, most of us turn to our own families, right? And it's really hard, or to our own communities. And the older generation hasn't really had the same, they didn't have access to the same information. There's so much happening in the research world about the brain and about child development that so informs how we think about discipline and how we think about what kids need in order to cooperate. What are people who maybe raised us, but maybe didn't have access to that information, right? We get into the same cycle that we're trying to get out of. There are some things that I want to do differently. And yet, like, when push comes to shove, right? And we get stressed with our kids, the thing that we fall back on is like, what's living in our bodies?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's how we were raised. And so it takes work, I think, to get out of that.
No, definitely.
To go for a different way. Mm. Yeah.
And how do you go for a different way when you're in a partnership, potentially, and you have differing views on how to raise children? How does that work? That's always a conversation I have with parents, is that they're coming at it potentially from two quite different points of view.
You know, when I work with people, I always want them to include their parenting partners, whether that's a spouse or, you know, a grandparent or a nanny or whoever it is. I think it's really important to be on the same page. And I hear so often that sometimes we can't do that. And when we can, I think it's really neutralizing and really comforting to be able to just say, this is the approach we've chosen and we don't have to fight about it, right? Because this is just an approach. This is what we picked. This is a neutral thing. We're going to agree on this approach. And then we sort of like free ourselves from all of the opinions and ideas, because now we have this thing that we're doing together. Right. I think getting on the same page is half the battle, right? It's like, you know, if you're like negotiating screen time or something, and like mom has one idea and dad has a different idea, mm-hmm. our kids feel that. And like that kind of ambiguity is so hard to manage for children. Right. And then the behaviors just really start, and it might be about the decision, but it's probably about the ambiguity and the lack of clarity, right? And the you know, the non-agreement between the parents.
Yeah, and they're very, you know, kids are very clever, they're very switched on, they're watching everything that happens, they're observing, they're taking it all in, and they will work out a way to play the system if they're allowed to, I guess.
Well, yeah, and I mean they're smart, right? It's like they're smart. And so I always think about it as like, what does my child need here in order to cooperate? Like, what kinds of experiences do they need in order to get through this more easily? And like, probably one of the things that they need is to experience their parents being on the same page. Yeah. Right. Or at least being able to say, we're going to try it mom's way for 2 weeks, and then we'll try it for dad's way for 2 weeks.
So what is the biggest challenge? I mean, it's a bigger question, which is an answer to this question. What is the biggest or most frequent challenge that comes up? And I know obviously it would depend by age of child. So let's say kind of maybe younger kids, maybe age 5, 6, 7, that kind of, just as an example. What's the biggest challenge that parents are coming up against, do you think?
Yeah, I think that there's so many different challenges, right? For different families. I think that the sibling dynamic can be really hard for some families, right? Supporting kids to be able to get along, whether they're sort of saying mean things to each other or fighting over objects or just can't play together at all for more than like 2 seconds. I think that's a big one, but there's also many others, right? It's like, I think a lot of parents right now are struggling with hitting, physical aggression, you know, as we get up into the elementary years where there's homework, I think that's a really big tension point for folks. And I think the underlying thing, you know, it's like expressed differently, right? But the under, like the current that runs all of those things and all of the other challenges people have, you know, inflexibility and not able to cope with not getting my way or whining or any of these things. The undercurrent is really stress.
Okay.
Right. Where it's like stress is anything that kind of gets in the way of cooperation. And that, I mean, we've been in a pandemic for 2 years. Like, yes, our children are very stressed. Yeah. And so are we.
Yeah.
Right. And so our kids are just, you know, they're reading us. They're hardwired to feel our feelings. And so when we come home from work and it's like, just give me 2 hours, right, till bedtime. And then it's the worst night ever. It's the stress that we're bringing into the relationship, and our kids are reading that and reflecting it right back. And I think most children right now are pretty stressed.
Yeah.
They're carrying a lot of trauma from the last couple of years and really need us to slow down. And so whether it's expressed like as fighting a sibling or refusing to eat dinner or ripping up homework or like perfectionism or any of these things that are really challenging, bedtime troubles, I always look at it as like, okay, how do I just kind of be a stress detective here? Where is it coming from? Yeah. And how can I meet the need so that I reduce the stress and I shift the culture of the family a little bit?
So how do you deal with it when you have, I mean, I completely understand the stress being a kind of foundation that's, if it's obviously not, if the foundation is rocky, i.e. there's stress involved, then everything that happens on top of that is going to have potentially a negative outcome. But when there is stress and your detective work has identified the cause of that stress, but yet the child is still misbehaving or being whatever, so something that it makes you feel bad in some way, you get to a point, maybe I'm speaking too personally here, you get to a point where you know there's a reason for them to be behaving a certain way, but they've pushed your buttons to the point where you're just going to flip. Where is that balance between understanding they're in a stressful or carrying stress, but there is a limit to how much you're prepared to allow?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about taking care of ourselves, right? So I don't think that you can help a child, actually know that you can't help a child calm down if you are not calm, right? If all of your buttons are pushed. And so I would say if you're in a place where it's like, I'm not ready actually to be with this kiddo right now. It's too hard. I am too tired. I need to sit down and have a cup of tea, right? I need to call a friend. I would say I would drop the rope on that behavior until I've taken care of myself, right? So I might go into another room because we're going to make it worse, right? If I go into a meltdown with a child, and I'll give you an example just from last night with one of my own kids where this was going down. We were at dinner and they had stayed up the night before. So this is a 7-year-old. And they'd stayed up just about an hour beyond bedtime, but you know, that was enough to sort of make the next day kind of dicey. So we're at dinner, it's the end of the day. And she just was a little rattled, a little kind of off and not super into the meal that I had made. It was a meal that they'd never had before. Even though they did end up liking it, you know, it's like meeting something new. So there was some feelings around, it was baked potatoes, right? There were some feelings around the way the baked potatoes looked. And she started saying really provocative things like, I hate when mama cooks. Mama always cooks. And I wish your mama wasn't in our family. And then it's like, I have two choices. I can say, we don't speak like that. Right. And even when I just said that now, you can feel the tone in my voice.
Yeah.
Right. Had I said that to her, she would have probably gone worse. Mm. Right. So what I did for her was just recast. So I just said, oh, I'm not sure about these potatoes. And she repeated back, oh, I'm not sure. Right. Which is fine. Right. I'm going to leave it there because I can look at her and tell that she's not really in a place where she can take in my correction.
Yeah.
Right. So my only goal in that moment is to like, just, you know, drain the stress off of her, like if I was a Steve, right? And then later I get to have my own feelings about the fact that she just said that I wish that she wasn't in my, wasn't in her family, right? And I can do that by like going to another adult or going to a yoga class. But it's a practice. It's hard to not be reactive to that, of course, right? Yeah. Especially if you're tired and it's the end of the weekend and like you've got a big meeting in the morning and, you know, for all of the reasons. But me yelling at her at that moment or telling her to go to her room or anything really would have probably resulted in more of that.
Yeah, yeah. And then would you then pick up, so after the situation is diffused and that's sort of the moment has passed, if you like, would you pick up the conversation with her at a different time to express how it made you feel?
Right. I think you have to be careful with that. And I think sometimes you can, right? And if I am going to pick it up, like the time that I like to pick things like that up would be sort of before bedtime, maybe after I read a book, when we're sort of having quiet, laying in bed with her sort of moment. And I might just say, that was so tricky at dinner time. That was so hard. Can you believe it? Right. You really weren't sure about those potatoes and then you liked them. And I might say, I bet next time when you're frustrated or something new, you'll remember to always use kind words, right? I'm just going to prime her forward. I'm not going to get into the weeds about like, then I felt really bad because you said this and in our family, we don't talk that way. I'm just going to prime her forward. Like, I don't know, it might be tomorrow when you're feeling that way where, you know, like I can take a deep breath or I can say, Mom, I need a hug or whatever your coping mechanism is for her, or him. But I'm always like wanting to prime her forward. Like,
yeah,
I know you've got this, right? I know it's going to get easier. I know you're going to figure it out. We'll do it together.
And is your seven-year-old part of the twins? Are they the twin seven-year-olds?
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And I don't have twins. I don't actually know any twins, I don't think. How are they as individuals? Because they are obviously individuals. But because they're twins, is there any similarity in the way that I suppose they behave or act and the way you have to then deal with them?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because they are both so alike and so different, right? So as, you know, as people, they could not be more different. One of them is like, I would say highly sensitive, but generally like pretty able to get through tough moments, right? She can kind of roll with the punches until she can't, right? Until there's something, that was a story about this twin, right? Mm-hmm. Until she's too tired or too hungry or, you know, for whatever reason, she's been working too hard at school and she can't hold it together anymore. But generally she's pretty able to kind of hold her own, roll with it, go with it. Her twin has a much harder time rolling with the punches, right? So her twin is also really sensitive, but needs a different set of tools. So her sister, you know, if she's in a major upset, just needs to know like the next right thing, right? So she's operating from a different kind of mindset where she needs to know just how to move forward. What is the step that I can take? She is much more provocative, right? And she will get into it with me and with her dad much more easily, right? She's a little bit more inflexible. So we're working on like stretching her flexibility, right? But they also operate as a unit sometimes, right? So like last week, they both had this sickness, right? They like a little cold, but they had it at slightly different times. And it was pretty hard for both of them to go to school on the day that sister wasn't going.
Okay.
Right. So it's like, there's ways in which they kind of twin up, I always call it, right? It's like kind of a safety mechanism, you know? Like I'm a little nervous, so I'm just going to like hang with my twin. And we've had to work on that. Sometimes we'll go to a play date or into a scenario where they're not super sure. And it can feel really exclusive to other friends, right? Where it's they're, you know, they just twin right up, right? And they stick to each other. So they're working on that. But I think that's a, you know, they actually have another set of twins in their class. And I hear that from those parents too.
Yeah, I can imagine this. And it's a beautiful thing. Of course, it must be a beautiful thing to have that in your life. But I can see how yourself in that twin bubble, maybe too much, I suppose, if it's not done.
Totally. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's like we want them to be able to have that and go out of that.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like, I want to nurture that, and I also want to nurture independence, right? Mm. So I think it's just a balance, like most things are with parenting.
Yeah. And you talked about perfectionism, or you mentioned perfectionism earlier, just in one of the words you mentioned. And it comes up a lot in my coaching for adults, perfectionism. It's sort of, in my experience, is very much an adult sort of challenge that people have of trying to be perfect everything. Expectations are very high, with their own expectations or expectations from other people or from their employers or from their friends or family, whatever it is. But I guess, as you said, perfectionism, my daughter came into my head, because she's definitely, my older daughter who's 12, she's definitely a perfectionist. And until you said that just now, in my head, she was just a bit annoying when it came to things like she has to have the right socks on that, you know, exactly the same. And certain things have to be a certain way, because her expectations of certain things are very high for herself. But thinking about perfectionism from an adult point of view, actually, it does obviously come out in, well, much earlier in life. So where do those expectations come from when they're so little, apart from self?
I mean, I think a lot of us have a thread in our lives that starts when we're quite young and expresses itself through adulthood around perfectionism. And I, you know, I think perfectionism comes from wanting to feel a sense of belonging and being unclear about how others are going to perceive us. Right. And so being really hard on ourselves to make things perfect so that we can belong. Right. Or what are they going to think? And so a lot of kids, I mean, I don't know if this is true of your daughter, but a lot of children with this profile, and I've got one like this too, right? It's like, you know, 4, 5, 6, drawing something, learning how to write, and it doesn't look right. Mm. And so your kid starts to erase, right? And it's like, there's going to be a hole in the paper because they're like erasing so hard. And the parent, you know, the kid is like kind of edgy. Right. And then the parent comes up and might say something like, oh, honey, it looks great. Don't worry about it. It's okay. We all make mistakes, or anything like that. Yeah. And I think we inadvertently like entrench these kinds of beliefs around perfectionism. And I can't do it when we do that, because our child's experience is like, it doesn't actually look how I want it to look. Why can't you just like say that, mom? Right. And I'm hurt too all the time. You know, I'm like, it looks like an amazing unicorn to me. Right. And I think as we, you know, what I want for our kids is to be able to process through those feelings so it doesn't get stuck. And like, then we all turn into these like kind of tense perfectionist adults. Right. So the way that I can help my child process through is just by kind of reflecting back. So I might just say, wow, it's not what you wanted it to look like. Mm-hmm. Right. And it might just, you know, it could even just be sounds, kind of like, oh no.
Yeah.
And then I get to just be in it. Right. That's the way to sort of move them through. But it's hard, right? These are tricky things.
Yeah, well, I think we're also just programmed, maybe because of books or whatever, programmed to say things like, oh, never mind, it still looks great, or don't worry, or don't be so silly. And that's, I know that's one that you will definitely disagree with, but something we say so commonly is, oh, don't be silly, it'll be fine. Which, of course, I know when I say it out loud, that is not a productive thing to say to anybody, so implying they're being silly or something. I can obviously see that, but it just happens so naturally. For those sort of words to come out, unless either we go on a course with someone like you, or we actively reflect and stop and pause, which again, most of us in our busy parenting lives don't really have time to do.
We do not have time. And I, you know, it's about neural pathways, right? It's like we, you know, it's like you just said, we're kind of programmed, right? And we are. Our experiences, and probably when most of us were children, people said those kinds of things to us, right? So people said, don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. Or it looks great. And we felt like it didn't look great, right? And so it's no wonder that we say that kind of thing to our kids because of the way our neural pathways have been laid, right? And I really think that making a shift there does not happen in individual spaces. I don't think it happens when you read a book, right? I know it's like, if I had 25 cents for every time somebody was like, I've read all the books and it still hasn't changed, right? It's like, yeah, you need, learning happens in community. Like it happens with other people, like with a group of people who are having the same challenge, because you have to rewrite the pathways and it takes time. It's like, oh, here's a different way I could approach this. And then you have to practice. And of course, we're not going to get it right all the time, which is so hard for kids who become adults and then parents who like had perfectionist tendencies then and like want to be perfect parents now. Right. And we have so much more information about how to be a perfect parent, whatever that is, not a thing. Right. So then it's like, you know, if I get it wrong or I do that, and I can just go back and say, wow, can you believe it? Mom said, whatever. And I just missed it. I was thinking about that. And I was thinking that maybe you actually really didn't like how that unicorn looked.
Yeah.
Is that what happened? Right. So you can always go back and like do a redo, you know, that there's so much permission to do that. The goal is not to like get it perfect all of the time. It's just to like be in the relationship and be vulnerable enough to say to your child, oh, that was not what I wanted to do. Or gosh, can you believe I'm still learning to close doors quietly? I'm going to get it soon, right? I'm going to remember that when I'm mad, I can still close the door quietly, right? It's like, you know, you just get to own it.
Yeah. We're probably quite lucky. We have no doors downstairs in our house. It's all open plan. So there can't be any slamming upstairs, yes, but not downstairs. And then just going back to your parenting courses that you run, do you do them in a group? Because I've got a question around the group dynamic.
Yeah, I do. I do work with some people one-on-one who really want that. But I always encourage people to really consider being in one of the groups. So I make cohorts and they're together for 12 weeks. So they're quite intimate. They're usually, you know, 4 to 8 families. And people really get to know each other's kids and each other's parenting. And that I just think is where, like, that's where the magic happens. Right. It's like, oh, I'm not the only one. Like there is another family whose child has hit the parent, or there's another family where the kid says the same thing, or there's another family who is at a total loss too.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We're not alone. We're like not siloed. And sometimes it's loads easier to see what another person could do with their child than to notice in your own family, like, oh, that's what went down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I
know better for you, don't you?
Basically. Yeah. Totally. I think there's so much goodness in just being able to show up and say how it actually is and make some shifts.
Yeah.
Right. And I really think that happens in community.
Well, as you say, we have expectations as perfect parent from the books and from the blooming internet, which has now caused us so many problems in the world. So to be in a community where that perfectionism is actually taken away and you're allowed, I suppose given permission to say, I'm not perfect. I think I'm getting this wrong. And someone else goes, no, we're doing it the same way. And it's, you know, all in the same boat, which we know we've talked about this just before we came on air. It's so important for parents to realise they're not all alone and we're all in the same boat. And we're all muddling through in our different ways.
I don't think parenting was ever meant to be done by yourself. Right. And in the modern world, like oftentimes we do it by ourselves. But it wasn't supposed to be that way. Right. It wasn't really meant to be done that way. And so then it's like, okay, where can I find the places where I can be with other people, yeah. right? Yeah. Given that I live here and I do this and like I have my life looks this way. It's like, where are just like the little spots? Where mm-hmm. are the 5 minutes when you drop mm-hmm. your kids off at school or pick them up that you get to connect with other parents? Yeah. And where yeah. are the organized spaces where you get to connect with other parents? And mm-hmm. how can we make it so that there's a little bit more connection?
Yeah.
Right. For adults too, because our kids are watching. We're, you know, modeling is like the strongest tool. And if I want my kids to be able to show up and navigate their feelings and calm themselves down and do all of this good, you know, be good people and be empathic, I have to model that. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I have to show them how to do that in my mm-hmm. own life and relationships. Mm-hmm.
And a question actually on role modeling, a question I often ask my guests on this is more sort of career work related. But when your kids look back in 20 years time, when they're going into the workforce and they're, you know, flying the nest, etc., what would you like them to look back and think of about you as a working mum? What would you like them to be remembering?
I love that question. You know, I think that I would like them. So they were quite young when I left my academic job. But I would like them to be able to hold on to, I can shift here. Right. So that academic job for me was like my dream job. I got a PhD to get exactly that kind of job. It was at a very elite university. That's what I always wanted. It was everything that I ever wanted. And I left it because what I wanted changed.
Yeah.
Right. What I wanted shifted. And that was really hard. It was really hard for me to figure out who I was going to be in the world if I wasn't that. Mm-hmm. And so I would hope, like, I don't know, part one of what I would hope for them is to be able to hold on to that and to know, like, you know, your working life is one part of who you are and you can reinvent it as many times as you want. And the other thing that I would really want them to hold on to, and that I hope that I've modeled for them, is that you can, you know, you can invent your job, right? You get to make it up if you want. And it's so funny. The other day we were driving home and we were talking about different people's jobs and what they want to be when they grow up. And one of them said, "You made your job up." And I was like, I did not make this up. That was my first reaction. I was like, I did not. This is a real thing, right? And then I stopped and I was, you know, we got home, whatever. And I was thinking, I've been thinking about that. And it's so funny that my initial reaction was like, I did not, this is real. As though something isn't real, like as though you like need to validate your thing, because the truth is, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I did make it up.
Yeah.
Right. She's not wrong. So, you know, I want them to be able to know that, like, you can make something up if you want, right? Mm-hmm. There's no bounds. You get to make things up and you get to design your working life so that it fits you and so that it matches your life. And I don't really think I had a lot of models for that, right? My parents were both teachers. It was like sort of more square. So yeah, you know, I'd like them to be able to know that they can shift and change. And I want them to be able to make up their jobs if they want. yeah. And, you know, it's an interesting question. So I have all girls, and when I was an academic, I was at an Institute for Gender Research, and a lot of my colleagues were studying girls and young women in the tech workspace and how gender kind of shapes that experience. So I'd also like them to, I don't know, feel like they can have a critical eye towards gender and race in the workplace, and that they, you know, can have a voice and speak up for that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because who knows, in this, what, 14 years, maybe for your kids, the world is going to be a completely different place to it.
Totally.
From a workplace point of view. I mean, it's changing by the minute at the moment. So God knows what jobs will be even exist for them. It'll be a completely different space, which we don't even predict, really.
I think that it is really shifting. And I think there are a lot of people who are making up their jobs now more than there were just even 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely.
The pandemic has really shifted that.
Yeah. And do you think then having kids shifted your perception as well from wanting to make your job up? Was that having a kid's catalyst in there as well as your own sort of timing?
I think it's complex where that comes from. I had breast cancer in my late 20s when I was doing my PhD. And I think that had that not happened, I probably would have gone straight into a tenure track job and stayed there. And I might have had kids. I probably would have had kids, but they would have been sort of like later in life kids.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, I think there was like a sequence of things, right? That happened. And then I was like, I might die. I just want a baby. Mm-hmm. Right. So then we had two babies.
Yeah.
Right. at once. And so it's, I think there is just a sequence of events that mm-hmm. really shifted the way that I was thinking about the world and my priorities. Right. It's like, it's hard to say whether it's the cancer or having twins, but after those two events, I was just like, I don't want to go live like in some city where I don't know anyone, which you have to do if you're an academic. Mm-hmm. It's part of the deal for most people. I want to be close to my family. Mm-hmm. I want to be close to my mom. I want my kids to grow up with their cousins. So that was a real values shift. Mm. Right. And I think it's part kids and part cancer and part just like when your life falls apart like that, and then you start to put it back together, it's like the puzzle is different now.
Yeah. You know what's important then, or what was important is different.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
That's not to say, I mean, it's not to say that I'm grateful that happened. It's just to say like I'm different now. And it would have been fine without that, but it certainly wouldn't, my life would look very different. I'm sure I doubt that I would have this organization, that I currently have. I think that's like very much a product of, just of shifting away. I mean, what I was studying was still the same. I think my cancer really kind of shifted me away from focusing on research and prestige and towards relationships and being in people's lives.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Well, any change obviously depends how you manage and navigate any change in your life, and whether you take a different path to create an opportunity for yourself or whatever it is. But it's, as I said before about shifting, it's entirely your choice to make. To shift and change things up.
Yeah, I think that's hard. It's hard to make big changes like that. And it's hard to turn away from something that you have always wanted, or something that feels like, I know what this world is. Mm. Like, I know how to be here. I can do it. And somebody in one of my mom's groups recently said, like, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah.
Right. And I just thought that was so, and you know, it's so simple, but I thought that was really insightful and something that I hope that my kids and I, you know, all kids get to walk away with, right? Mm-hmm. Which is part of the thing about perfectionism. Like, if you've got a perfectionist outlook, it's like, just because I can, I definitely will, and I will do it perfectly. Right. And it's like, okay, just because I can doesn't mean I should. Maybe I should do something different. Like, maybe just there's a different freeing way that will feel better.
Yeah, it's a very freeing thought when you think of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no should. And I always say to everybody, the should shouldn't be a word in our vocabulary.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I think that if we got that rid of that word completely from our parenting, it's like our kids, that would be so hopeful for our children. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, anytime anyone starts off with like, well, but my kids should be able to, mm-hmm. they're 10, they should be able to pack their backpack, or she's 14, she should know to do her homework, or she's 7, she should definitely be able to get dressed by herself. Right. It's like, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Clearly they're not doing it. So Maybe we should start there.
Yeah. And it's fine. It's fine.
Right? Let's start there instead of where they should be. And then you can work towards where they are and where they're going in a way that honors them.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So Chelsea, we haven't got access to you in person living in different continents. So if a UK listener or anywhere European listener can't get to you physically, how can they get to you virtually? Where can they find you or find more about you or your positive parenthood or that kind of thing?
So all my courses are actually on Zoom.
Okay.
Right. So pre-pandemic, we used to meet people in person, but you know, everything's different now. So everything's on Zoom. And I think there's two places where folks can find more out about positive parenthood. And the first place is our website, which is just positiveparenthood.org. And I recently got an Instagram coach. So my Instagram is super fun. So we've been playing on Instagram a lot. And the handle is at @DrChelsea_parenting.
Okay.
So those two places I think are probably the best ones to find out more.
And what is your sort of parting words of wisdom to any, and it's obviously quite big, any parent going through anything, is there one thing that you could say that would cover everybody?
Oh my gosh. I think that I would want to tell all parents that I think they're doing a really wonderful job and that it's really hard. Parenting is really, really tricky, and we all deserve support. Right? We all deserve to be able to say how things are, and we deserve to be able to receive support. And for me, it's like, we don't have to really guess at all of the things, right? There's so much brain research that we can use in our parenting to better understand our children and better understand ourselves and make things a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Right. And we're joyful. It's like, you deserve to be a joyful parent and to nourish yourself and nourish your children through this process.
Yeah. I think that's so important. You mentioned it earlier, but looking after ourselves, we forget. So easy to forget ourselves and focus all on the kids or on the family or whatever else it is. And we can't do a good job unless we put ourselves first now and again. Not first, alongside, but somewhere up there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can do simple things. Like, you can say, like, for me, it's like, I really like to go to the beach. So I just take my kids to the beach a lot. Mm. Right. That's nourishing for me. And they also have.
Yeah.
Right. It doesn't have to be like a huge, gigantic thing. But putting ourselves is, you know, taking care of ourselves is really important. Yeah, and definitely. It's important to model that for our littles.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Chelsea. It was a fascinating conversation. Thank you. And I'm sure there's plenty there for all parents to take something away from that. So thank you so much. And I'll put all of your details in the show notes anyway, so everyone can find you wherever they need to on Instagram. I will check you out and have some tips, because I haven't got a coach and I probably need one on Instagram. Awesome. Thank you so much and have a good day.
You too. Thanks so much. Yeah. Take good care.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Parent Equation. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review, as every little really does help. You can find me at aishamurray.com or join my Facebook group, The Working Parent Equation, where you'll be part of a great community of like-minded parents, and you're most, most welcome. Until next time. Thank you.